Hello, my name is Sarah, and this is Places to Sleep. I will read to you some place descriptions from different works of fiction as a backdrop for you to be able to drift off into sleep. Tonight's Places to Sleep will come from The Well of Loneliness, a 1920s classic of lesbian fiction by Radcliffe Hall. Not very far from Upton-on-Severn, between it, in fact, and the Malvern Hills, stands the country seat of the Gordons of Bramley, well-timbered, well-cottaged, well-fenced, and well-watered, having, in this latter respect, a stream that forks in exactly the right position to feed two lakes in the grounds. The house itself is of Georgian red brick, with charming circular windows near the roof. It has dignity and pride without ostentation, self-assurance without arrogance, repose without inertia, and a gentle aloofness that, to those who know its spirit, but adds to its value as a home. It is indeed like certain lovely women who, now old, belong to a bygone generation. Women who in youth were passionate but seemly. Difficult to win, but when won, all fulfilling. They are passing away, but their homesteads remain, and such a homestead is Morton. Page 44. Father and daughter rode home through the twilight, and now there were no dog roses in the hedges. The hedges stood leafless and gray with frost rime, a network of delicate branches. The earth smelt as clean as a newly washed garment. It smelt of God's washing, as Stephen called it, while away to the left, from a distant farmhouse, came the sound of a yard dog barking. Small lights were glowing in the cottage windows, as yet uncurtained, as yet very friendly, and beyond, where the great hills of Malvern showed blue against the pale sky, many small lights were burning. Lights of home, newly lit on the altar of the hills to the god of both hills and homesteads. No birds were singing in the trees by the roadside, but a silence prevailed more lovely than birdsong. The thoughtful and holy silence of winter, the silence of trustfully waiting furrows, for the soil is the greatest saint of all ages, knowing neither impatience nor fear, nor doubting, knowing only faith, from which spring all blessings that are needful to nurture man. Sir Philip said, "Are you happy, my Stephen?" And she answered, "I'm dreadfully happy, father. I'm so dreadfully happy that it makes me feel frightened, 'cause I mayn't always last happy, not this way." He did not ask why she might not last happy. He just nodded, as though he admitted of a reason, but he laid his hand over hers on the bridle for a moment, a large and comforting hand. Then the peace of the evening took possession of Stephen, that and the peace of a healthy body tired out with fresh air and much vigorous movement, so that she swayed a little in her saddle and came near to falling asleep. The pony, even more tired than his rider, jogged along, with neck drooping and reins hanging slackly, too weary to shy at the ogreish shadows that were crouching ready to scare him. His small mind was doubtless concentrated on fodder, on the bucket of water nicely seasoned with gruel, on the groom's soothing hiss as he rubbed down and bandaged, on the warm blanket, clothing, so pleasant in winter, and above all on that golden bed deep straw that was sure to be waiting in his stable. And now a great moon had swung up very slowly, and the moon seemed to pause, staring hard at Stephen, while the frost rime turned white with the whiteness of diamonds, and the shadows turned black and lay folded like velvet round the feet of the drowsy hedges. But the meadows beyond the hedges turned silver, and so did the road to Morton. Page 122. In the quiet old house, there was discipline and order. Death had come and gone, yet these things persisted. Like the well-worn garment and favorite chair, discipline and order had survived the great change, filling the emptiness of the rooms with a queer sense of unreality at times, with a new and very bewildering doubt as to which was real, life or death. The servants scoured and swept and dusted. From Malvern, once a week, came a young clockwinder, and he had set the clocks with such care and precision, so that when he had gone, they all chimed together. Rather hurriedly, they would all chime together, as though flustered by the great importance of time. Puddle added up the books and made lists for the cook. The tall underfootman polished the windows, the iridescent window that looked out on the lawns, and the semicircular fanlight he polished. In the gardens, work progressed just as usual. Gardeners pruned and hoed and diligently planted. Spring gained in strength to the joy of the cuckoos. Trees blossomed. Outside Sir Philip's study glowed beds of the old-fashioned single tulips he had loved above all the others. According to custom, the bulbs had been planted, and now, still according to custom, there were tulips. At the stables, the hunters were turned out to grass, and the ceilings and walls had a fresh coat of whitewash. Williams went into Upton to buy tape for the plates which the grooms were now engaged upon making, while beyond, in a paddock adjoining the beech wood, a couple of mares gave birth to strong foals. Thus were all things accomplished in their season at Morton. Page 248. Stephen bought the house in the Rue Jacob, because as she walked through the dim gray archway that led from the street to the cobbled courtyard and saw the deserted house standing before her, she knew all at once that there she would live. This will happen sometimes. We instinctively feel in sympathy with certain dwellings. The courtyard was sunny and surrounded by walls. On the right of this courtyard, some iron gates led into the spacious, untidy garden, and woefully neglected though this garden had been, the trees that it possessed were fine ones. A marble fountain, long since choked with weeds, stood in the center of what had been a lawn. In the farthest corner of the garden, some hand had erected a semicircular temple, but that had been a long time ago, and now the temple was all but ruined. The house itself would need endless repairs, but its rooms were of careful and restful proportions. A fine room with a window that opened on the garden would be Stephen's study. She could write there in quiet. On the other side of the stone-paved hall was a smaller but comfortable salle à manger, while past the stone staircase a little round room in a turret would be Puddle's particular sanctum. Above, there were bedrooms enough and to spare. There was also the space for a couple of bathrooms. The day after Stephen had seen this house, she had written, agreeing to purchase. Valerie rang up before leaving Paris to inquire how Stephen had liked the old house, and when she heard that she had actually bought it, she expressed herself as being delighted. "We'll be quite close neighbors now," she remarked, "but I'm not going to bother you until you evince, not even when I get back in the autumn. I know you'll be literally snowed under with workmen for months, you poor dear. I feel sorry for you. But when you can, do let me come and see you. meanwhile, if I can help you at all. And she gave her address at St. Tropez. And now, for the first time since leaving Wharton, Stephen turned her mind to the making of a home. Though, through Brockett, she found a young architect who seemed anxious to carry out all her instructions. He was one of those very rare architects who refrain from thrusting their views on their clients. So into the ancient, deserted house in the Rue Jacob streamed an army of workmen, and they hammered and scraped and raised clouds of dust from early morning all day until evening, smoking harsh caporal, as they joked, or quarreled, or idled, or spat, or hummed snatches of song. And amazingly soon, wherever one trod, it seemed to be treading on wet cement, or on dry, gritty heaps of brick dust and rubble. So that Puddle would complain that she spoiled all her shoes, while Stephen would emerge with her neat blue serge shoulders quite gray, and with her even hair thickly powdered. Sometimes the architect would come to the hotel in the evening, and then would ensue long discussions. Bending over the little mahogany table, he and Stephen would study the plans intently, for she wished to preserve the spirit of the place, intact despite alterations. She decided to have an empire study, with gray walls and curtains of empire green, for she loved the great roomy writing tables that had come into being with the first Napoleon. The walls of the salle à manger would be white and the curtains brown, while Puddle's round sanctum in its turret should have walls and paintwork of yellow to give the illusion of sunshine. And so absorbed did Stephen become in these things, she scarcely had time to notice Jonathan Brockett's abrupt departure for a mountaintop in the Austrian Tyrol. Having come suddenly to the end of his finances, he must hasten to write a couple of plays that could be produced in London that winter. He sent her 3 or 4 picture postcards of glaciers, after which she heard nothing more from him. At the end of August, when the work was well underway, she and Puddle fared forth in the motor to visit divers villages and towns in quest of old furniture, and Stephen was surprised to find how much she enjoyed it. She would catch herself whistling as she drove her car, and when they got back to some humble auberge in the evening, she would want to eat a large supper. Every morning she diligently swung her dumbbells. She was getting into condition for fencing. She had not fenced at all since leaving Wharton, having been too much engrossed in her work while in London, but now she was going to fence before Buisson, so she diligently swung her dumbbells. During these 2 months of holiday-making, she grew fond of the wide-eyed, fruitful French country, even as she had grown fond of Paris. She would never love it as she had loved the hills and stretching valleys surrounding Wharton, for that love was somehow a part of her being. But she gave to this France that would give her a home, a quiet and very sincere affection. Her heart grew more grateful with every mile, for hers was above all a grateful nature.
Page 300. The villa was older than the streets of the Porto, although much grass grew between their venerable cobbles. It was older than the oldest villas on the hill that was known as Old Orotava, though their green latticed shutters were bleached by the suns of innumerable semi-tropical summers. It was so old indeed that no peasant could have told you precisely when it had come into being. The records were lost, if they had ever existed. For its history, one had to apply to its owner. But then the owner was always in Spain, and his agent, who kept the place in repair, was too lazy bother himself over trifles. What could it matter when the first stone was laid, or who laid it? The villa was always well lit. He would yawn, roll a cigarette in his fingers, lick the paper with the thick red tip of his tongue, and finally go to sleep in the sunshine, to dream only of satisfactory commissions. The Villa del Cypress was a low stone house that had once been tinted a lemon yellow. Its shutters were greener than those on the hill, for every 10 years or so they were painted. All its principal windows looked over the sea that lay at the foot of the little headland. There were large, dim rooms with rough mosaic floors and walls that were covered by ancient frescoes. Some of these frescoes were primitive but holy. Others were primitive but distinctly less holy. However, they were all so badly defaced that the tenants were spared what might otherwise have rather been a shock at the contrast. The furniture, although very good of its kind, was somber, and moreover it was terribly scanty, for its owner was far too busy in Seville to attend to his villa in Orotava. But one glory the old house did certainly possess, its garden. A veritable Eden of a garden. Obsessed by a kind of primitive urge towards all manner of procreation. It was hot with sunshine and the flowing of sap, so that even in its shade held a warmth in its greenness, while the virile growth of its flowers and its trees gave off a strangely disturbing fragrance. These trees had long been a haven for birds, from the crested hoopoes to the wild canaries, who kept up chorus of song in the branches. Thank you for listening to Places to Sleep. I hope that you've drifted off along the way, but if you haven't, that's okay. Sometimes, even when you can't sleep, it's nice to think about places where maybe you could.